Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the television series Twin Peaks. This podcast is brought to you by Nerdship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I am your host, Steve.
Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast, so if you have not watched the entire series of Twin Peaks, please do so before you watch this. We would love to have you on board and listening to us, but we don't want to give anything away.
If you would like to support this podcast, the best way to do it is to go to iTunes and write us a review. That would make us very happy if you wrote one for us.
We know you're listening. Just take 2 minutes out of your day and write a review. It makes us float on cloud nine for a whole week.
I know you think about it while you're listening to us, and then you forget about it.
Or maybe you think to yourself, I'm not the reviewing type person. I just listen. I don't give reviews. But you can cross over to the other side and become a review person. I didn't used to be a review person, but now I give reviews.
Yes, or you can just click on some stars.
Either way works.
Also, another way is to write us some feedback. We've gotten a lot of feedback from Daniel and Joel, and they continue to write in feedback, but it would be great if we had some others join in the conversation.
Sometimes their feedback makes this podcast, and we want you guys to be part of that too. So we're in the dregs of season two right now. If you've already watched Twin Peaks, which I tell everybody to make sure they've seen all the episodes first before they listen to us, you know where we're at with this. So we need some listener feedback. We need some help to make this an enjoyable and listenable podcast because Harley Payton's just not delivering it right now. Frost and Lynch are out to lunch, if you know what I'm saying. So, Daniel and Joel are doing the heavy lifting, and we totally appreciate it, and we want that to keep happening. But we also want to hear from some other people, too.
They want to hear from other people, too.
Yeah,
Joel
yeah.
has actually expressed that. So, you know, it's great to have this community and to have a whole bunch of different ideas that start to, you know, kind of swirl around in the pot, and it just makes it more interesting. So, you know, even if you think your idea is stupid, try it out. Like, throw it out here. Use a fake name. You know, nobody's going to know who you are. It's just like, throw it out there and we'll discuss it. It'll be fun.
And I mean, you know, feedback doesn't have to, like, Joel and Daniel write some really well thought out, some very insightful things, and they know a lot about Twin Peaks, more than we do, a lot more than we do. And, your feedback doesn't have to be on that level.
Right.
You know what I mean? You know, you can write something better than Twin Peaks is cool, you know, but it doesn't have to be on that level. With those guys, I feel like we're almost a four-member podcast in a certain sense.
I was going to say, they're kind of like honorary
hosts. Yeah. So we're saying this on behalf of them as well to just, you know, if anybody's got some ideas, and it doesn't have to always be episode specific. If there's something you want to say about Twin Peaks in general that would be worthy of discussion, send it on in. We also have an Amazon link. If you go to noship.net and click on the Amazon link, it takes you to the Amazon homepage. You can do your shopping like you normally would, and we get a little bit of kickback from that, but it doesn't cost you a penny extra. No cost to you, but you know, we get some money for coffee and donuts and RSS feeds and storage and all that kind of stuff.
I would also be remiss to not actually give the link to where you can reach us for feedback.
Since we just went on
about feedback. So that would be, if you want to write us some feedback, go to our website at noship.net and you can click on our contact page and go to our Gmail account. If you don't want to go that route, you can just write to us directly at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. And we also have a Facebook and a Twitter you can communicate with us by.
I have a PSA for the remainder of the podcast. For your safety and ours, please stay on the bike. Unless you're James Hurley, in which case, just don't ever come back.
Harsh. All right, so before we get into recap, are there any thoughts on this episode before we get started?
This one's written by Harley Payton, and I feel like he has to carry a lot of weight here. And it's a mixed bag of results. So there's some bright spots, though. There's some parts that I just don't remember happening from the first time I watched it through, and it made me laugh out loud.
So you're not too – like, to me, this was the worst episode I've seen. But
I mean, I could agree with that. I could definitely agree with that. It's just that I'm trying to look for the bright spots, you know, because I don't want people to tune into us and just be like, oh, they're just going to thrash this episode like they did the last three and probably the next five.
We're not going to thrash it. It's just that's just how I've felt at this point. This so far has been the least satisfying episode of Twin Peaks for me.
I guess it feels – you're right. I could definitely go with that. I could definitely see it being the least satisfying one. But then we could be saying that next week and the week after as well.
We might, yeah.
So I'm just waiting for – I seem to remember one where they do a beauty pageant.
Yes.
So that's on the horizon. So yep. Just waiting for that one. But you know, whereas before, I think I've said something similar to this effect, but like, you know, you have the parts that are just filler, these side stories that we really don't care about, and they used to be interspersed between the good parts. They're just almost the whole episode now, so that's what we're dealing with.
All right, so this episode is Twin Peaks Season 2, Episode 13, and it's titled Checkmate, and it is written by Harley Payton and directed by Todd Holland. Okay, we open with a vision of space. Cooper's name is whispered, and a triangle symbol or object spins into view.
It almost looks like the hazardous waste symbol.
Yeah, it reminds me of that too. Major Briggs is being questioned by Truman and Cooper, and Major Briggs reveals that he saw a giant. There is also a brand on his neck, which is in the same design as that triple triangle, and Major Briggs is deeply affected by this experience, soul shaken even. He talks about Project Blue Book, and then he begins to talk about the White Lodge when they are interrupted by a military officer who has arrived to escort Major Briggs elsewhere.
So he's kind of at the point now in his life to where he's being very reflective, and he's like looking at everything that he's done and saying, you know, every time anybody ever has asked me this question about what I do for a living, I always defer to the answer of that's classified, I can't talk about it. But now keeping secrets really doesn't hold that much of an import for me, and this information that's been bestowed on me by whoever is so important that I need to share it. And then of course he starts talking about the lodge and then the knock on the door.
Right.
And these guys are here obviously at the behest of Colonel Riley. And as I'm not trying to take over your recap, but
Go ahead.
corrections department on my part, I had mentioned that the actor who plays Colonel Riley last episode, who was in the Rocky films, I said that he was in the first four and then had a cameo in five. He's actually in Rocky Balboa, the sixth movie, as well. I'd like to put that out there because I think it's important that people know that.
I'm sure all of our Twin Peaks listeners are relieved that you corrected that.
Well, you know, I don't want anybody to stop listening because they're as big of a Rocky fan as I am, and they're going, this asshole doesn't even realize that he was in Rocky, you know, Balboa, Rocky Six, and he was training him, you know.
Understand. I like to correct myself too. I'm just messing with
Okay,
you.
so enough on that.
So Cooper looks at the polar after, you know, Major Briggs is gone, Cooper looks at the Polaroid of the brand that was on his neck, and water begins to drip from the overhead sprinkler, which, you know, the last time that dripped was when Bob left Leland's body.
Yeah. So that I'm not really sure what's supposed to be being conveyed to us here because the sprinkler was, and you know, we kind of missed this one and our listeners brought it to our attention that the sprinkler was the water that put out the fire of Bob.
Right.
So you have a little bit of residual water dripping down on this, but is it supposed to signify that it's evil and maybe there's more water that's going to be needed to, but without getting too much into it, the whole interstellar aspect or interdimensional aspect or both of these beings seems to me to be a little bit more complicated than just black and white good and evil. So I think it played out well as a nice visual, but I'm not sure if the significance of it is just going over my head or if it's not there to
Well,
be seen.
I thought the whole like interstellar part was just kind of dropped since the original message actually was traced back to the woods.
Yeah. But I mean, the episode does start with that brand coming out from
Yeah.
space, so they haven't dropped it completely, I guess.
So Ernie and Denise prepare to set the buy for the drug deal. Cooper arrives and Ernie makes the call. He oscillates from false bravado and naked fear before the telephone connection is made.
Is this a? No, this isn't the scene where Hawk's wiring him up. That's a little bit
No,
later.
no.
Okay, yeah, I don't have anything to
This is
say
the
about this
scene where
scene.
Denise is massaging his shoulders and
Yeah,
he's like, "Get off."
he's kind of just like, oh, stop. You know, I know people who dress like that guy. They
Ernie.
wear like the sports jackets and the gold chains and the watches and stuff like that. This guy I know dresses like that. Yeah,
Okay.
he's a pool shark and he's a gambler. He's a hustler, card player, and
Does he have chops?
he doesn't have chops, but his haircut has been the same. I've known him for a little over 20 years and his haircut's the same and he refuses to cut it. He says if he ever started losing his hair, he'd call Dr. Jack, as in Kevorkian, to kill himself. It's a ridiculous character. But anyway, I know somebody who could be that in 10 years. Hooray for me.
Yeah, I was gonna say good for you. I've heard a lot about this guy, but I've never met him. Okay, so now Andy walks into the sheriff's department and says hello to Lucy and encounters Dick. Dick is dressed as a sleuth, and He's there primarily seeking Andy's aid in getting to little Nicky's records. Lucy tells Cooper she has not found any chess deals in any local publications as of yet.
Yeah, the two short, quick little scenes with these characters, and I noticed one thing, one theme that runs throughout this episode is that people are just on the edge of other people's peripheral vision, and then they come right into focus as those people exit stage, and it happens three times, I think. So there's people there. Lucy walks out of the room just as the Andy Dick Show, as I call it, is walking away, and then there's another part where I think Catherine goes into Ben's office just as Audrey and Bobby walk away. And then later on, Hank Jennings is somehow standing in the middle of the living room right as Norma and Ed kiss goodbye, and nobody sees him. Nobody sees any of these three people as this is going on. So that I don't know if it's just something fun that they did or if it was completely unintentional and coincidental, but I'm just like Cooper, I don't believe in coincidences.
There's that, and there's all the couples too that are hooking up.
Yeah, I didn't even think of it from that angle. So, you know, at the very least, we're not getting a lot of good story, but they're throwing in little tidbits for, you know, repeat watches to kind of go, aha, there's this or that or the other thing.
And Dick is, I mean, they like to have sleuthing characters in the show, like armchair sleuthers, and Dick is my least favorite, of course.
I will say that I don't like the Andy Dick Show, but I do like kind of a little bit the fact that they're getting along, and you know, Lucy is just kind of pushed out of the equation now. It's almost like this little bromance between the two of them that's brewing. Like the real relationship is going on between them, and because of the little Nikki distraction, she's almost forgotten by the wayside. It's weird.
They're bonding over this.
yeah
So now Ed is at the double R and he tells Norma they need to talk. And he does it by sliding, the bill over to her and the tip. And on the back of the bill, it says, "We need to talk."
yeah because Hank is always, you know, hovering around somewhere sucking on his dirty domino, so you got to be slick, and Big Ed's not known for his slickness, so that was
That's
actually
right.
a pretty good move on his part.
So at the Johnson's household, Shelley is over her new position as Leo's nurse. Bobby says he's not coming back and that he is Ben's new boy. It's a golden opportunity, and that he has better things to do than bathe Leo. She asks, "Don't you think I have better things to do as well?" And he says, "Not that I can think of." So she slaps him and he leaves.
That was a deserved slap, because
Oh, yeah.
that was a dick thing to say. But you know, this we saw this coming a mile away. Even the first time I watched the series through, you know, at some point that Bobby's just going to be like, "Hey, you married this jackass. He's your problem. I'm out of here. I got to go try to, you know, get on Ben Horn's good side and try to screw his daughter." So
The theme to Invitation to Love is playing over that scene too.
that I did not notice.
It's a whole like soap opera tropey scene, so they're playing that to hit the nail on the head, pretty
Kind of being a
much.
little bit meta with themselves.
Yeah, Daniel brought up the music last episode in his feedback, but the music stuck out more for me in this one. I don't know why,
I think
but
it's more appropriately used in this episode, because
maybe.
Daniel was bringing it up because it was just done badly. It was put in scenes where it didn't need to be, if I remember correctly, or maybe that was the episode before it. But Daniel had brought up how the music was just not matching up to the scene that it was put with, because they were taking themes from earlier in the episode just to kind of like pull the nostalgia lever.
So James calls Big Ed saying he needs a favor. He wants all of his money out of a savings account and sent to him. He does not reveal anything else when Ed questions him. Evelyn walks in and wants to know if he is homesick, and he says no, and then she asks about Twin Peaks. She wants to know about the women he ran from. He talks about Laura, but not about Donna. He says he lost himself basically when Laura died, and I'm just gonna throw out there, I don't understand his story about that, the way he, I just don't understand him.
James is a bad communicator. He doesn't get across. If you've noticed, I'm not trying to be funny, all of his scenes that he talks to people, he's halting, and he's written that way. He's not a bad actor. He's just written to be a bad communicator. He can't get across what he's trying to get across, and he's always this angsty, frustrated character that wanders through life, and if everything's not going completely his way, his first impulse is to just bolt. But you're absolutely right. He mentions Laura, and then he says, "And then another girl got murdered, and I had to leave." So he mentions Laura and he mentions Maddie, but he doesn't mention Donna at all. So either he doesn't give a flip about her, or else I don't know.
I just don't understand what he's saying when he says that He's talking about how he thought he knew who he was, he thought he owned his life, and then after Laura died, it turns out that she owned his life. And I just, don't understand what he's
I
saying.
think that's a metaphor for a relationship, because when you're in the good parts of a relationship, you feel like you're on top of the world and you can do whatever you need to do, and you don't realize how integral this other person is to your happiness. And then when that person is pulled away for whatever reason, it doesn't have to be a death, they could just dump you, then you start to realize like that hole in your heart that's there is where they used to be. So I think that's what he's trying to say by that. But
Well, that makes sense. I mean,
he's still a bad communicator because he could have just said what I said.
not according to her, because she feels like she can read everything on his face. So maybe I should just quit listening to what he says and just
Just
stare at his
watch his face.
face.
Yeah, like when you do the recap, just turn the volume all the way down and just be like, James,
Oh, okay.
he's
Totally get
going,
you.
from dumbass to angsty back to dumbass. Now he's smiling. So he's
Whoa, he's smiling. Because we actually see him smile this episode.
yeah. So the least that can be said, or the most that can be said, I guess, or however you want to look at it, is that at least Evelyn makes him smile. This scene I thought was kind of absurd for another reason too. This guy's still in high school, and his legal guardian, which is Big Ed, is wiring him money to a bar.
And not questioning him enough, not insisting enough.
I just couldn't imagine any member of my extended family being cool with that. They'd be like, No. I'm gonna come get you right now. Why the fuck are you not in school? I mean, this guy's, assuming he's a senior, he's missed, say, since Laura died, he's probably missed 99% of the days that he should have been there.
Yeah. Well, let me just finish this scene. So he looks at the bruise on Evelyn's face and asks, why does she let her husband hurt her? They hear Jeffrey, her husband, leaving, and she tells James that she needs his help. Okay, next scene. Nadine approaches Mike Nelson at the Double R. He says, oh, Lord. She offers to buy him a cherry pie to share. He wants his own. He does not want anything to do with her, and he is very explicit about this, and she is still undeterred. She kisses him and then apologizes, and she leaves a bewildered Mike behind.
I'm liking the reinvention of Mike, because when you first get to know him, and he's Donna's boyfriend and he's doing all this sinister stuff with Bobby and everything, he's a bad
He
character.
is such a dick in the first season.
Yeah, he's an asshole and he's very unlikable. And when he says to Ed, he's like, "Oh, Ed, I'm not your friend." It's like you just want like the coyote from the Warner Brothers cartoons to just drop a
Anvil.
Acme, anvil on his head. But like I'm starting to actually not necessarily like him per se, but just enjoy his acting. I'll say that.
Well, I was thinking after I'd watched this episode, there's nobody better to have her hit on than Mike Nelson in this whole show, and nobody better to have her beat their ass than fucking Hank.
Yes, that
Ser
was,
That was good
yeah,
choices by these guys,
that
but
was part of the silver lining. I've already
yeah.
stated that I'm not a big fan of the whole Nadine regression storyline, but this is the one that made me laugh out loud that I hadn't seen it. I'll talk more about it when we get to it, but I enjoyed it.
So Norma prepares to leave when Hank questions her about where she is going. He protests her going because he may end up in the weeds with scrambled eggs, basically. And she leaves, telling him to consider it a test.
Did she not think he was gonna follow?
Well, I mean, apparently he's the only one there.
Yeah.
So he leaves later, and who's fucking manning the double R?
Yeah, that's a business. I mean, you can't
Yeah.
just have like people walking in going,
How does he
there's
explain
nobody
that to
here.
her?
There might be like one other waitress who replaced Shelley that we've seen in in the background at one point.
Where's the German waitress? We haven't seen her since the pilot or something. Anyway,
Yeah.
so Truman confronts Josie at the Packard's place, wanting to know why she has not moved into his place. He wants to take care of her, and she keeps saying she is safe here. He begins to kiss her. She tells him to stop and to look at her, that she is Catherine's maid, and that she is not good for him. He says she is good for him and continues to kiss her. And like he has like a kind of a animal attraction towards her, I think.
You're right, though. He loses all kind of logic and reason whenever he's around her. He just gets into this, worked up into this frenzy.
Well, he doesn't even ask her about the maid uniform. She has to point it out to him, unless there's some sort of missing scene that where she's explained it earlier. I mean, you think she has the cap on when she answers the door, and she takes it off quickly. They walk into the kitchen together, and he doesn't even ask her about what the fuck are you wearing? This is not Josie Packard clothing, but she has to bring it up.
That's a really good point. I didn't think about that. He's just so hot to trot to get into her panties that he
Yeah.
doesn't care at all that she's wearing a maid. Maybe he
Yeah.
thinks it's hot or something. I don't know. But like, why, if you go over to your girlfriend's house and she's wearing a maid's uniform and you know that's not her profession, it's like, are you playing some weird sex game with somebody else I need to know about? You know, is cousin Jonathan around or I don't know.
I like Truman, but the way he approaches this relationship sometimes, and even when they're not even in the same room together, I don't know what it is, but
It's his Achilles heel. He's a great, solid character besides Josie, but they funnel every negative aspect of his character that they could have into her. So he doesn't have flaws in other areas necessarily that stand out, but here they just concentrated on her. Whenever he's around her, he loses himself.
I think it's just because we're judging this show, and you've mentioned this before, from the standards we have these days too. There's, and I'll explain more on that when we get to another scene that involves him. Okay, so now at the Great Northern, Audrey encounters a humiliated Sam, which I guess is an assistant to Ben Horn, in the hallway, and asks what's wrong. She gets no straight answer, and Audrey ends up rushing into her dad's office and discovers him intently playing at Civil War with a impressive display. Audrey gets on the horn to call Jerry. I was thinking about it, and I'm sure this is probably a big duh thing, but he's playing at Civil War, and obviously he's the Confederates because he feels he's been defeated. And he's playing at Civil War because he's got this dichotomy in his mind that's warring inside of him, because he's I think the last episode he was talking about trying to achieve balance and all these things, and I think he's trying to find out who he is because
The Civil War in his mind is an attempt to him playing it out is sort of an attempt to rectify the two sides of him, the side of him that wants to be a good person and a good father, and the side of him that is this criminal bastard, statutory rapist, the whole nine yards,
I
you
mean,
know.
maybe those are the two sides. I'm not sure exactly what would define the two sides, but there's definitely something warring inside him, and one's good and one's evil.
Yeah. Once
So.
again, we have the duality and the dichotomy of Twin Peaks again. One thing I thought about the scene, you had mentioned a couple of episodes ago, I think, or maybe it was last episode, I don't remember, but you had said that the state of his office is kind of like in microcosm, the state of the show at
That
any
was last
given time, and
episode,
last
yeah.
episode. And now, as you said earlier, that this is probably the worst episode that you've seen yet. That are least fulfilling at any rate, or least
Yeah.
satisfactory. If you look at the state of his office, he's actually dug up the floorboards and there's dirt underneath, you know, where he's playing with these things. You can see it. You can see like the structure of that actual room has been changed. He's removed things and dug things up and stuff. Unless I'm reading that wrong, and maybe he just brought dirt in and had some wood put around it like a playpen or something. But either way, it's in complete disarray. It's chaotic. It's broken down. You can see things in the background that aren't where they should be. There's no feng shui going on. So maybe this is part of their going, look, we know it's bad, folks, but just bear with us. It's going to get better.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he dug up the floorboards or not. I didn't like look super closely. I thought maybe he had built a model where you would use like sand, where you kind of glue it to
Yeah.
like spray glue and then sprinkle sand to make it look like there's dirt. I don't know. That's what I assumed was going on.
Well,
Like,
'cause
is
when Audrey walks across his little battlefield, you know, he thumps on something and you can see dirt rising into the
Huh.
air. So I'm not, that doesn't necessarily mean he dug up the floorboards. I mean, for all I know, his office could be on like the second or third floor of the Great Northern, and that's not feasible anyway for him to dig up the floorboards and have dirt underneath. But
Yeah, not sure. I have to pay attention. Okay, so now Norma arrives at Ed's place. She tells him that he is the last thing she thinks of at night and the first thing she thinks of, etc. It's really nice things,
yeah, it's
but
actually really romantic.
yeah. And then she tells him she wants to be with him no matter what happens, and he kisses her. So this is our, what, second couple that's starting to get it on, 'cause we had Josie and Harry first.
And Andy and Dick.
So now at the sheriff's department, Hawk wires a sweaty Ernie. Cooper has Ernie repeat his instructions. Cooper regrets not being able to join them, and so Truman deputizes Cooper. Ernie begs to get out of this to no avail. Denise arrives as Dennis.
Pretty slick with the hair pulled back
Yeah.
and everything in the suit and stuff. I really like this scene because I really like the scenes between Cooper and Truman because I value friendship and those guys are good friends and I really like their friendship. And so it was nice for him to be like, I've already got that covered. And he just tosses him a deputy badge. And Cooper doesn't laugh. He doesn't think it's funny or tongue in cheek or anything. He just straight up says, I hope I can live up to this. And he's completely earnest and serious about it. And that's the other thing, real quick, I was going to say about it is his badge has the number 13 on it. And I don't know if this is because this is the 13th episode of season two or if this is, just the whole like triskaidekaphobia thing around the number 13
Probably.
or what, but it's there.
So this is the scene, or the scene I was talking about, where I feel that they're not fully fleshing out Truman's character in regards to his relationship with Josie. Like, they're not making it realistic enough. He should have questioned her about her maid's uniform in the last scene we saw him. And in this episode, he should look like the weight of the world is on him, but he doesn't. He's sitting there cleaning his gun. In a very cavalier way. I think anybody who has a relationship with somebody like Josie is going to at least have a furrowed brow or something. And he doesn't look like he has a care in the world there. And it's just, all it is a simple touch to add to somebody. I think somebody has said this somewhere. I don't know if it was Joel or Daniel, but this is where it's most evident to me that the show has lost its base notes. It's there, that lower level is not helping the rhythm, and it's not carrying through every scene. You know what I mean?
That's a good metaphor for it. Yeah, we don't have the backbeat going on at all
Right.
to keep with the musical stuff. The show is now not all about that bass. It's
Whatever.
got a lot of trouble, is
Yes.
what's being said here.
Okay, so back to the Dick and Andy show. They break into the Home for Boys records room. Andy is on watch while Dick searches for little Nicky's records. He finds it pretty quickly, and then he begins to read it right there. They are startled by a couple seeking adoption of a little boy named Donnie. Dick begins to spin a weak lie to them.
It's a cute scene in a Andy Dick show kind of 90s comedy funny ha ha way, but
They couldn't get a nerdier couple to come in.
oh man, I mean, could you imagine those people being your adopted parents?
What are they trying to say
I don't know,
with that couple?
like
Like, I don't know.
what it's almost like they're saying, we don't know if she can conceive or not, but we don't have sex, so we're gonna adopt
Look at them. They
the
obviously do not have sex.
child. We love each other, but we're not attracted to each other at all.
We're an
And she,
asexual couple. Okay.
yeah.
Anything else on that scene before we move
No,
on?
no.
Okay. So Donna knocks on Ed's front door. She tells Ed she needs his help because she cannot find James. He tells her that James is fine and that James has requested a delivery from him, and she offers to take it for him. She leaves. Then Norma comes out and she says goodbye to Ed. And then as soon as Ed turns around, Hank is there and begins to beat up Ed. But then Nadine walks in and then she beats Hank's ass.
This
She
is a good
says,
scene.
"Look out."
This is a good scene from top to bottom because we have the beginning of it when Donna talks to Ed. It's a setup for Donna, actually meeting where James is at
Right.
later on down the road. And it's also a good thing to say, like, look, somebody is actually missing James, because Ed's not going out of his way to find out where this kid is, so she is, his I guess she would be his ex-girlfriend at this point because they broke up. I don't know. But she leaves, and then whenever I don't like the fact that Ed was getting beat up by Hank because I would like to think that like Ed could probably hold his own, and that was one of those Twin Peaks punches, like when Truman hits
Right, the one you can see
Albert.
coming
Yeah,
miles away.
it's just like, hey, I'm about to hit you in 3, 2, 1. It's one of those, and I don't know. Maybe it's just because my first exposure to Everett McGill as an actor was Dune. When he was Stilgar, and Stilgar would have killed Hank Jennings out of hand.
Without a thought, yep.
He would have taken his water for the tribe and left his body for the worms. So, but anyway,
And he would have said, huh, after. What does he
But
do? Isn't it something like
it
that?
is something like that when they talk about giving them countenance in the tribe.
Yeah.
It's a way to
Oh, well, he wouldn't give him countenance.
I think David Lynch came up with that because it's not really in the books, that kind of verbal enunciation, or nonverbal audio enunciation. Anyway, then Nadine comes in and kicks some ass. I love that scene.
Yeah, you were cracking up hard.
That made me laugh out loud because I forgot that it was going to happen because I was like watching it again and I was like, oh shit, Hank Jennings is kicking the shit out of Ed. Where is this going? And then Nadine comes in. I'm like, oh yeah.
It's so campy. This
It is.
episode's very
It's
campy.
campy, and I've said it before and I'll probably say it again. I don't like the Nadine regression subplot, but this is a bright point in it. It's hilarious.
So now Bobby listens to Ben's delusion. Bobby tries to interrupt with no success and continues to suffer the performance. Audrey peeks inside right before Ben's going to accept Bobby's unconditional surrender. Bobby says he has to go talk to Lincoln first and that he will get back to him on this whole surrender thing. Do you think if Bobby had surrendered, if this would have resolved everything for Ben?
I don't know, 'cause when you see his hands and the camera's focused on Bobby's face, but you see Ben's hands are
They're
shaking
shaking.
'cause he's ready for him to give that saber back,
Yeah.
and he doesn't do it. So it is a good point. Like maybe Jacoby wouldn't have been necessary. Like if he had given it back to him, it would have completed a kind of like a circuit loop,
Because
and he
later
would have
on they
been
act everything out with him,
right. So
since Jacoby suggests that.
yeah, possibly, 'cause he looked like he wanted it, and then Bobby just kind of leaves the room. So.
Bobby's just disappointing people everywhere.
Yeah, left and right. I mean, the kid can't even make it to football practice, or now that season's over, baseball practice, or whatever.
So Bobby talks to Audrey about her dad's condition, and she says that Jerry's on his way and that Dr. Jacoby will be there tomorrow. She tells him not to call her baby.
Yeah, because as they walk off screen and Catherine comes in screen, another one of these shots where they just didn't notice that she was there. He says, "Good job, baby," or something like that. She goes, "Don't call me baby." I love the way that they're hanging on to this whole thing that like she's resisting or she's just immune to
Yeah, there's no resisting. It's just not going to
the
happen.
Bobby Briggs charms. It's just like
Yeah.
whatever, you're barking up the wrong tree.
So Catherine pays a visit to Ben Horn. He is not so deluded that he does not recognize her immediately. He asks her if she is there to gloat, and he tells her to go ahead, gloat, that she has defeated him. She admits that she did come there to gloat, that he double-crossed her, that he tried to kill her. However, she still finds herself wanting him. She tells him that he makes her body hum, and then she tells General Lee to kiss her, and he does. He nuzzles his face into her
Bosom.
bosom and says, "Victory!"
Don't really know what to say about this scene. I don't know if this is a setup scene for later on because they're gonna have more to do with each other again, and I can't really remember, but it just seems out of character for both of them because after, or maybe that's the point, because after everything that they've been through, there's a magnetism that just keeps drawing them together, and no
Yeah.
matter how much they screw the other one over, no matter how much one of them goes through some crazy crap and another one's going crazy, that they still find themselves at that point where they're in the hotel room about to get down again.
Yeah, they have a sexual connection. At least she does to him.
Yeah.
And I think when she's looking at Bobby and Audrey, I think it's supposed to be like maybe that's how her and Ben were when they were in their youth too.
Oh,
Just
that's a good point. Yeah, let's go with that because that makes the scene absolutely redeemable in my opinion.
So now James walks a blindfolded Evelyn to show her the repaired Jaguar. They share champagne. She tells him that he has an honest face and that she can read his face. She wants to know his plans. She does not want him to leave. And then she asks him to give her more time. They start unzipping each other's fronts and kissing. Are we supposed to compare all these makeout scenes? That's what I wrote here. And her brother Malcolm, who's not really her brother, is watching, by the way.
You don't know if you're watching this for the first time, you don't know that that's not her brother, and you're just kind of like, ew, why is he snickering? You know,
Why is he
because
smiling?
some guy's about to bang his sister in broad daylight. Another thing about this scene is weird because Evelyn's like, my husband's going to be home at midnight. That doesn't leave us much time. It's obviously like 6 in the afternoon, or actually, it would still be sometime in February or early March at this point, going by the calendar of time. So. It's probably like 3 in the afternoon because the sun's going to set pretty early in the wintertime. There's no, she's saying that midnight isn't that far away, but the sun's still up. So that time of year, the sun's going to go down because the time hasn't changed back over to daylight savings yet. I know this is nitpicky, but they made a point to have her say it. So.
How cheesy is that time? Like midnight, really?
Yeah, he says he's going to be home right at midnight.
I don't know.
Yeah. They had at least 6 hours. If not more. I don't know how much banging they intended to get done, but I mean, that's plenty of time to do it.
Anyway, whatever. I just once again, wooden acting and weird. And I think it was in the Oral Reflections, the actress who plays Evelyn Marsh, I forget her name. She they were really drinking champagne, and apparently they were quite tipsy during that scene, but it
Oh.
did nothing to aid
No, it didn't make them loosey-goosey or anything. It
her
just
anyway.
it made them just like more wooden almost. Well, her, yeah, he's actually smiling for the first time,
I
so that could be explained
know.
by the bubbly. That's what Donna needs to do. She just needs to pour some champagne down his throat and he'll just be happy.
So Cooper scouts Dead Dog Farm through binoculars while listening to the wiretap. Ernie is sweating and it does not go unnoticed. John then discovers the wire because he starts to smoke because of the sweat. Is that would that happen? And why, when Hawk was putting the wire on, why wasn't that even discussed, like that this is a
I don't know
possibility?
if that's a possibility. I really know very little about that kind of thing. I don't know much about electronics at all, but common sense tells you that you would have to be sweating pretty profusely to actually sizzle and fry out wire. But maybe not. Maybe, but see, I would think that it would be because people are going to be nervous if they're wearing a wire because the people that they're trying to, catch on tape, if they figure it out, they're going to get shot. So,
Seems like the worst thing that will happen is that the adhesive that's holding the wire to you would
oh,
come loose.
yeah, that would probably happen first before it got
Yeah.
drenched, but
But of course, so John Renault begins yelling Cooper's name because he knows he's behind this, and now we have a hostage situation. Cooper offers a trade of himself for Ernie and Denise. Truman has Hawk call in backup, which is going to be the state police.
once again, not only in this scene by calling in the backup, but also with the taping of Ernie and everything like that. And then later on, whenever he goes to check the generator,
Hawk's doing
Hawk
all the
is
work.
doing all the real police work. I never would have thought about this if Daniel hadn't pointed it out,
I
but now it's fucking glaring now. Every time I watch a scene with those two in it, Sheriff Truman, as much as I like him, is doing little to nothing, and Hawk is just making the place go, you know?
right, now it's night. Evelyn leaves a sleeping James in bed. Malcolm, the creepy butler, brother, driver, encounters her outside James' room and they embrace and kiss. Malcolm keeps saying, "Lucky boy," like a creep.
Oh, he is creep of wheat for sure.
Evelyn looks conflicted,
Yeah,
but I don't really care.
yeah. This is all part of her plan, but she has honest feelings for James, though.
They had sex, so now she's in love.
Yeah, nobody cares. Nobody cares.
So now the state police arrive at the Dead Dog Farm. The Monty freaks out when he sees all the sirens, and he now panically says to Renault that they need to make a deal or run. After Renault questions Cooper about this, Cooper tells him his only option is to surrender. Renault is not sure whether to give up quietly or to kill Cooper and talks about this aloud. Cooper asks why is his dead body so important, and Jean says Twin Peaks was a well, he mentions his brothers that Cooper has he feels was responsible for his brothers, and he starts talking about how Twin Peaks was a sleepy town, quiet and really unattentive to the drug dealing that was going on before Cooper arrived. Cooper's presence threw everything into a chaotic state. He brought a nightmare with him, maybe, is what he suggests. And really, this is the only probably line
Link.
or just other than the overhead sprinkler dripping, and then you have this conversation that's going on, or monologue from Renault that connects it with the whole mythology.
Yeah, you're right.
And he's suggesting that maybe Cooper brought the nightmare, and maybe the nightmare will die with you, which is interesting. Denise then approaches, dressed up like a Double R Diner waitress with a tray of food, and of course, not recognizing Denise as Dennis. Jean's immediately okay with it's just a girl, because back in these days they didn't have characters on television shows like Lagrith. I mean, it's just
Yeah.
it's the most stupidest thing that this character
It's
who's supposed to be some big bad would just like overlook anybody. I mean, that's suspicious, but
pretty fucking ridiculous.
it is ridiculous. And it gets even worse because when Denise shows up and then just hikes up her skirt, who the fuck would do that? Like,
And
who
if
the why would he even like be
if the leg is clearly visible for Jean Renault to oogle over or ogle over, however that's pronounced. Because Coop has to be able to see the gun. He would see the gun first Because he's looking down at the leg, at the pantyhose and everything. So this scene is ridiculous through and through.
Yeah.
And another reason I liked it, but I didn't like it. There's the ridiculous part of it that you could just excise from it at, towards the end with the whole Denise coming in. That's just ridiculous. But the good part of it was when Renault was kind of saying, he comes to Twin Peak and he sells drugs to the teenagers and the
Yeah.
truckers, and then a beautiful girl dies, you show up, and everything changes. And that is really the only link that holds us to the Laura Palmer mythology that has anchored Twin Peaks to be what it is. You're absolutely right about that. So I like it for that, but what I dislike it for, besides the ridiculousness of it, is that maybe I've been watching too much Vikings lately or Justified or something, but I expected Cooper to be a little bit more brave and defiant in the face of death. Maybe it's a little bit more realistic that he wasn't, but his character so far to me has always displayed like when it comes time for that, he would just be like, "You're on the wrong side of the law. No matter what you do, they're going to take you down. So you do what you feel you need to do." That's what you expect out of that kind of character. I'd never expect that kind of behavior from myself, but I mean, he's there and he's got a cut under his eye from, getting roughed up by Jean, I'm sure. But, I thought he would face up to his fate. He seemed a little bit scared and a little bit shaken by this, and he was like, "Why is it so important to you that I die?" His main it seems like the older Cooper, his main focus wouldn't have been, "Why are you going to kill me?" But like to just try to confront the badness. That's just me. That's just my interpretation of that scene. I guess I'm saying that I felt like Peyton didn't write Cooper in this scene the way that stays consistent with
Yeah.
the way he was written before.
Yeah, I don't really have too much to add to that. I'm just,
Well, tell me if I'm off base.
I don't think you're off base. I just really have anything else to,
Okay, all right, let's
you're
move on.
asking me to say something, but I felt like my thoughts weren't applicable. So,
That's fine.
I'm just trying to think, how could they have written Cooper better at this point?
Yeah.
I mean, you've already stated it.
All I wanted to know is if you thought I was just being too harsh.
No, I don't think you're being too
Okay, all
harsh.
right, then, yeah.
That scene, other than, alluding to the lodge and its inhabitants talking about the nightmare and being connected to Cooper, that was the only thing I really cared for in
Okay.
that scene.
Yeah, we can move on then. Let's move on.
Okay, so now at the Johnsons, I don't know if Shelley put that record on or what, but she's laying on the couch and it looks like she's possibly fallen asleep reading a magazine, and she wakes up because the power is fluctuating, which is creepy. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen that happen in our house when there's power issues, but it's interesting.
The power's definitely flickered before. Any house I've ever lived in has power, during storms and things like that. But I've never seen it, like, it's almost like a near brownout. It just kind of goes and then comes back up. And at that, I don't know. I've never been anywhere where that's happened.
She gets off the couch and she looks for Bobby. She finds a wind up clown doll on the, is that Leo's bed?
That's what I assumed it to be because you can see the harness right next to the bed.
Okay, so she calls for Bobby, and the lights go down again. And when she sees that Leo is standing wearing a party hat,
And
she
with cake smeared
screams.
all over his face.
Yeah, and he says, "Shelly," and she screams, and the lights go out.
Shelly. She's looking at my headgear. Yeah, that's the scene's creepy. It plays out really creepy, but at the same time, you're thinking this guy's been incapacitated for a number of days. He's not going to be able to just get up and manipulate a situation and make the power go in and out and, place a doll on a bed and do all these things and be standing in a corner. It's a lot to.
She could have been sleeping there for hours, and he could have been over there in his chair saying, "Wiggle your big toe." And that whole time, he managed to get all his limbs working, and he was up.
So after he's gonna take Shelly and get in the pussy wagon and
Yep.
get out of there. I gotcha.
So now, at the Darkin Sheriff's Station, Truman, Lucy, and Cooper are standing outside because there's been a bomb threat. In fact, there's actually an explosion, and Lucy's reporting how there was a call and and the voice on the phone said there was a bomb planted in the woods, but she didn't know exactly which woods. And there was a huge explosion, and lights went out, and something strange also happened at the station. And she called the fire department. One of the fires was also at the power station. Hawk goes to check the generator because he says there's something strange. Cooper enters the sheriff's department and he uses his Zippo lighter to look around and he walks into Harry's office. He calls for Harry and Harry enters and sees that there's a body that's in his chair and there's strings used to maneuver and have this body pointing to a chess move on the chessboard. And Cooper says it's Wyndham Earl's next move. And I pointed out to you that this is actually Kyle MacLachlan's brother playing
It
the role.
obviously it looks like him because it's his brother. It looks like a version of Cooper with long hair.
Yeah, he's got that chin, that jawline. So, end of episode.
Yes, not one of the better episodes in the Twin Peaks pantheon.
Yeah, so I've said my thoughts throughout that, so I don't have any more to add. Do you?
Nope, I think we should get right on to feedback.
All right, let's go. Okay, so we have, of course, Daniel. And Daniel says, "Hey, Stephen M. And this week, the show continues to feel like it's struggling with its identity, starting off with a cheesy sci-fi sequence that feels more like The Outer Limits or something. We've already had references to Feng Shui. See, I don't know how to pronounce that.
I think it's either Fang or Fung, but that'll do. Feng
Okay.
Shui.
And the sentience of animals. And now they add UFOs, abductions, and strange markings left on the bodies of those taken. It seems like the writers were just throwing in random esoteric bits, and when Lynch returns, they will be mostly forgotten, though later shows like The X-Files will further explore this kind of stuff. That said, I prefer struggling to fit everything into a cohesive, esoteric whole. Shall we? Okay, yay. This is gonna be interesting. Okay. He says, "We can infer that the hooded figure seen during the flash of light in the woods, called the Guardian in the scripts, took Major Briggs away to the White Lodge. The memory of a giant owl brings to mind Whitley Strieber's attributing memories of owls watching him as screen memories, masking abductions by non-human entities in his 1987 book, Communion. I remember reading somewhere once that originally Frost had the idea that the appearance of the lodge would change depending on the mind of the observer who entered it when which may explain the shot of Briggs seated on a throne at some jungle temple. This concept no longer holds. However, since in the final episode, Lynch made the Black Lodge synonymous with the Red Room from Cooper's dream, which appears the same way to Wyndham Earl, Annie, Laura, Leland, and Philip Gerard in separate visitations. Like Briggs, the Log Lady will also reveal that she went missing in the woods as a child and upon her return bore a strange marking seared into her leg. My theory is that Mike's original fire walk with me tattoo from the left arm he cut off is the same kind of mark, and that perhaps the spirits are branding those who might serve as potential hosts. In an interview with the fanzine Wrapped in Plastic number 11, Al Strobel answered questions about his role in Fire Walk with Me. He said that the original tattoo was a symbol which we see on the ring in the film, and it represents the other place that they all come from. I don't know if he heard that from Lynch or Engels, but it's interesting. I dislike the reference to something real like Project Blue Book because of how it dates the episode. But I do kind of find it interesting the way it takes UFOs, which are usually interpreted as purely physical nuts and bolts phenomena, and mixes them in with the supernatural. I have no idea what they intended to do with the UFOs or exactly how they would have fit in with the Lodge mythology. But the Major's references to the investigation shifting to the woods around the town and the earth below bring to mind the connections between modern UFO stories and medieval folklore about the fairies, something the researcher Dr. Jacques Vallée did exhaustively in his 1969 book Passport to Magonia. It's like Twin Peaks is a spot where the barriers between this dimension and whatever else is out there are thin and all kinds of paranormal phenomena bleed through. While I really like that creepy shot of the sprinkler, any particular reason for a callback to what happened with Leland's death there? Todd Holland directed this one, and that sprinkler shot, as well as Hank and Norma's chat through the shelf, which is parodied on Sykes' Twin Peaks homage, Dual Spires, seemed to fit his grasp on Lynchian sensibility, especially comparing it to another episode he directed, Laura's Secret Diary, which has that creepy shot of the camera zooming out from a hole in his ceiling tile. I know we've touched on it before, but it is pretty uncomfortable to watch the way Harry immediately starts groping all over Josie when she's clearly not into it again. Maybe she should have never told him to tear that gown because now he thinks she likes it rough all the time.
He
Maybe
did.
that's ex
He did. But yeah, maybe we're judging Harry too harshly on that. Maybe he's like, look, this is how my girl likes it. So I'm
She
just
asked
trying
for it,
to. I'm.
right? She said no, damn it.
We're Bikini Kill, and we want revolution.
Right now. I love it when Ed turns around and Hank is there and he starts beating the crap out of him while his theme song plays. I start to think Hank is back, but then Nadine shows up and the scene becomes terrible and ridiculous, and I mourn the worst possible denouement for his character I once thought was so cool, because his time left on the show is not long and he's been utterly wasted. What a bizarre choice to have Catherine come back to Ben in that weird poncho and start making out and motorboating.
Motorboating. I haven't heard that term in forever.
I'm sure toe sucking was not far off also. I mean, it makes no sense for her character to be doing that.
You think maybe he said, "Can you put the Tajimura costume back on?"
Oh God. Daniel continues, "You can tell the whole Cooper being suspended plot was a little more than a stopgap for the writers to get their bearings and figure out what to do after Laura Palmer. The resolution is rushed and silly. When Denise comes up with food, clearly having been let through by the police around the perimeter, Monty King is so stupid as to ask Jean if he ordered any food when they are in a standoff." You're right, I didn't even think of that. It was also a little surprising the first time I saw it, seeing Cooper shoot Jean dead. I'm not saying he wasn't justified in doing so, but it's just surprising to see someone like Cooper actually take a life. Do you think Jean's speech about Cooper bringing the nightmare with him might be foreshadowing for his eventual fate with Bob? Which, because of the different way time works there, you could say that Cooper both will be trapped in the lodge and has always been trapped in the lodge. He was an old man there in his first dream. So the final shot of the dead vagrant is what made me realize that Windham Earl was probably not going to be handled well either. They are trying so hard to build up Earl as this ingeniously evil Moriarty to Cooper's Sherlock. But compare his elaborate art project tableau to something like the letters under the fingernails, a calling card which is so simple yet carries far more visceral horror when uncovered. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, agreed.
Sadly, still no word from Showtime as I write this, but here's hoping for a Lynch-directed new Twin Peaks. Yeah, it's still in limbo, I hope. I mean, I hope it's in limbo and not completely dead, but.
When Daniel says that he dislikes something, the references to something real like Project Blue Book because of how it dates the episode, I don't know if I necessarily agree or disagree with that. I can kind of see where he's coming from, but at the same time, it seemed like an attempt to kind of anchor it in reality and say, okay, Project Blue Book stopped this many years ago, but we've been kind of keeping it going on. That way they can take an already established, I don't want to say mythos, but for lack of a better term or framework, and just kind of carry it forward. But I've always had a soft spot for UFOs and stuff like that, and I don't really know if it fits into the lore and legends of Twin Peaks as well as it could. But I feel like if you've ever read a novel or a series of novels where the writer seems to go off on these tangents that just kind of like Robert Jordan comes to mind. He wrote, when he wrote his books, The Wheel of Time, there was a lot of stories and subplots that just kind of kept flowing outward from the center. And you're like, okay, when is this ever going to get brought back in? Now, the last three books had to be written by somebody else because he died, but we have a similar situation because, the primary writers are not involved with this show anymore. So you have other writers just carrying these side plots and they're kind of throwing stuff at a wall to see what sticks. And not all of it comes back around to make a complete loop and get fully explained, or and it doesn't
A
it's
lot of loose ends
a
end up.
lot of loose ends, and it's not like Lost where you have a smoke monster that never gets explained, but it's of a similar ilk to where there's these really cool ideas that get thrown out there, but they're just kind of like, well, we're not necessarily going to follow up on that completely, but it was neat, wasn't it?
Well, maybe there's an explanation as far as like using something like the Project Blue Book and the mythos as the way to make it more eerie for the viewer because that brings it closer to home. It makes it not something that only exists in this television show we're watching on Twin Peaks because we have our own mythos of things in our own actual world, and it makes it more eerie.
It does.
That's
I
just.
can agree with that. Yeah, I
Yeah,
agree with that.
and it's an attempt. It's not. I'm not saying they're successful, but it's an attempt to do that, to try to make it feel like maybe, what's going on in Twin Peaks could be happening hear,
Well,
or just even just to give you the sensation that kids put give you chills about it or something,
well,
but
one of the
that's
general,
all.
I agree completely with what you're saying. That's a really good point, and I didn't think about it because, but now the thought's forming in my head as I speak. But one of the general rules of horror, as I understand it, is that the closer you stay to reality, the scarier something is. And it doesn't have to be that way with just horror. It's also that way with science fiction. It's also that way with fantasy. The more rooted it is in some sort of reality that you understand and know to be true, the more impact it's going to have on you. You know, so using Project Blue Book was probably actually a good idea in some ways because it anchors us to something that we know or that we're familiar with. But I mean, we don't know if Project Blue Book is bullshit anyway, or I don't believe it is, but it could be. So we don't know. But just you get what I'm getting at. Like I said,
Well,
this was a
yeah.
thought that was forming
Well,
as
I
I
mean,
was.
some of the movies that have scared me the most have supposedly have some basis in reality. Like the Mothman prophecies horrified me deeply. Like I was like Major Briggs after, you know, like how Major Briggs, and then like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original. So that movie I can't watch ever again. You know, it's.
Which is a shame because, you know, it's such a good flick, but no, exactly, because you look at a movie like that and it's not some sort of, you know, and I'm not knocking John Carpenter at all, but you know, there's a lot of fantastic stuff that happens in a very like gory kind of way and gross kind of way in his movies. But in something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it may not be any less gory at the end of it, but you can see some shit like that actually really going down in some backwoods Texas town in the 70s,
Yeah.
which is makes it scarier, you know? I mean, a lot of the stuff that happened in the
Why did you bring
Amityville.
up John Carpenter? Did he do the Mothman prophecies?
No, I'm just saying that John Carpenter, he's a
I
obviously
know
a
who he
horror
is.
director, but like his stuff
In
is
fact, he
really.
directed Cheryl Lee in one of his movies.
He jumped to mind because I'm thinking of like The Thing. It's a
Yeah.
scary as fuck movie,
I have
but
not
it's
seen that.
super gross and there's a lot of fantastic stuff in there that you wouldn't really believe could actually happen. But with something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even though it's still gross, even grosser in some ways because of its closer link to reality. So Project Blue Book is acting like a link for the viewer to kind of be a little bit more creeped out or to give a little bit more street cred to what's being said. The other thing I wanted to hit on was the whole Hank Jennings thing. Daniel's talked about it before about how he liked, you know, Hank Jennings as a character when he first came out. I think what his quote was, maybe I'm just a sucker for a
For a
leather
leather jacket,
jacket.
yeah.
But, you know, he felt like he was this really cool addition to Twin Peaks. And at the beginning, he was. He was like this edgy kind of, who is this guy type villain?
Then he's
And
trying to
now,
do karate later.
badly,
I know.
badly. He got take like he started off in such a good spot and he could have gone to in so many good directions and I felt like he was wasted and I felt like I agreed completely with Daniel that he was wasted and I think Daniel would agree with me to say that he was one of a handful of characters that did not have a definite destination as far as story writing was concerned and now we're seeing the results of that,
Yeah.
unfortunately. And you know, we talked a little bit about Jean's speech about Cooper bringing the nightmare with him, you know, and foreshadowing Bob and things like that. But I thought it was pretty astute for a villain who's really only out for his own self-interest to have that kind of insight into what was going on and to link that to Cooper, you know. So it seems like everybody who comes into Twin Peaks or has some sort of dealings with it takes a little piece of it with them and understands it intrinsically. So, and yes, sadly, still no word from Showtime, but.
Maybe Jean Reno being, you know, probably the darkest villain that they've encountered is outside of like the supernatural there. I mean, obviously they're not dealing with Wyndham Earle in full capacity yet, so I guess Jean would be. I mean, he's definitely more devious and deft with his criminality than Leo or even Benjamin Horne, and because he's, you know, so. Let's say he's at the peak of that type of criminality. So, of course, he's going to be able to detect any type of darkness that possibly Cooper's carrying around. So, for him to suggest that Cooper may have brought the nightmare there, it might be a very astute, like maybe Cooper has Bob in him, and him suggesting that is not far off the mark.
Just a thought. Do you think maybe Cooper knows that there's some sort of
Yeah.
evil dark side rider that's with him, and this is why
Possibly
he
he might
adheres.
suspect it, because I mean, there's with his My Life, My Tapes, there is stuff that happened in his childhood with his mother and things like that. That so yes, I
So
think
do you
he.
think that's maybe what dictates his behavior, and that's why he adheres so rigidly to codes, because he knows what happens if you don't, and he knows what happens with him, at least, if you don't adhere to those codes, and the bad comes out, and shitty things happen,
Yeah.
like in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Who knows? There's a lot more to Daniel's letter that we're not hitting on in full, but I think he states it eloquently enough, and I don't have a lot to add to what some of the stuff he states, because
Well,
I'm
some
not.
of the theories, and also, I mean, some of the books he mentions that corroborate those theories. I have not read those books, so I can't really add
Yeah.
to
Like I said, this is almost like a four-person podcast, and
it.
Daniel and Joel's insights and research and amount of knowledge and depth of knowledge into Twin Peaks far exceeds our own. And we're very grateful to have them writing in, because it makes it a better podcast. Because at this point, we'd probably, either wouldn't be doing feedback, or we would be going. So yeah, the set design was really great on this one, don't you think?
I hope the fact that we haven't heard shit about Twin Peaks and Showtime at this point isn't a bad sign. It feels like it, but we'll
We're
see.
still a long ways off, because I mean, they targeted 2016, but if there's glitches and bumps in the road and they need to get things ironed out, I think a bluff is going on here. David Lynch is walking away. It's kind of like when you go to buy a new car and they're saying, this is all we can do. This is the amount of, money we can give you, or this is the amount of value. This is the only price we can go down to on this particular vehicle. And then the buyer says, all right, well, I'll see you later. And they wait until he's about to get into his car, and they run out and go, no, hold on, hold on, hold on. So David Lynch isn't quite to his car yet in their estimation, and they're just going to wait until he's there.
I just don't understand why they didn't figure all this out before announcing it and getting everybody all excited, you know?
Yeah, that does really seem like something that should have been hashed out before anybody said anything to anybody.
Because I understand that this is something he probably needs to do, but it almost makes me annoyed with him at the same time, too. I just can't help it. It's just how I feel right now, and I hate being annoyed with.
Well, just I, the only thing I can say is just give it time, be patient. I never thought there was going to be another Star Wars movie, and then one day I wake up and Disney buys the damn property from fucking Lucas for $4.5 billion, and then, that might be more of a careful what you wish for because you're going to get it type thing. But whatever, we're not talking about Star Wars, so
Yeah.
we'll see. There's still time. If they have to, they can push up the date. Maybe it won't come out till 2017
I just don't
or
think it's the
whatever.
same as Star Wars because this just felt like an impossibility. It seemed like the nail was put in the coffin that no, Twin Peaks is never going to happen. Like it was even stated. And then, well, now it is. And now it's not.
I don't buy that shit ever, though. Ever, ever, ever. I mean, I've been, I'm a big time music fan. I've been, shit, I don't even know how many years I've been listening to music, like with my buying my own music and listening since 1987. And in that time, if I had a nickel for every band who ever said, we are never gonna get back in the studio, we're never going to
The
record a new
Pixies.
album, we're never going to tour, we're never going
Yeah.
to do any of this, and then all of a sudden we're five albums deep into this band's like second leg of their career. They're touring the United States. It's all bullshit. People, when the payday's right, when the motivation's right, when all the other bullshit they thought they were going to do when the band broke up or the show broke up or whatever doesn't pan out, they always come back to it. How many times did Kevin Smith say he was never going to make another movie with Jay and Silent Bob? And then we get Clerks 2. It's just, you're not done until you're dead. So I don't think personally that I'm an optimist at heart, I think, even though I go through most of my day being a cynic, and a pessimist. But I think I am an optimist at heart, and I think this will get done.
I hope so. All right, so let's move on to Joel's. Joel says, "Hey, Stephen M., we're firmly in that mid-season stretch now, and unfortunately, as you may or may not recall, it gets worse before it gets better."
Wah, 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 wah.
I enjoy the beginning of this episode, although it's pretty over the top. Not exactly sure what they were going with there, but I guess the idea was that Briggs had some strange supernatural encounter in the woods, so they have him sitting on a throne in the forest. Though it looks more like a rainforest.
It
And outer
does.
space for good measure. It's a bit cheesy, but fun. And we also get some little hints, reminders of mythology. And of course, the water sprinkler drips onto the photo of Briggs' tattoo, but We also have him touching the wooden table and asking if it's meant for his soul, a call back to the log lady and what feels like foreshadowing if Josie's fate, though I don't know that was planned yet, because Josie's soul ends up in that wooden dresser drawer handle
And Margaret's husband's soul is in
is
the
in a log.
log, so then he's referring to the table. Maybe that's
Right.
where his soul is going to go,
That's interesting. I didn't make
because it
that
goes into the
connection.
woods, or wood, singular.
And that's all I've got for this episode. But I forgot to mention something you brought up on a previous podcast about the angels in Fire Walk With Me. Just to clarify, the people Lynch spoke to who convinced him to change the tone of the ending were not studio people. The past few weeks have reminded us how he deals with them. But the actor, specifically Cheryl Lee, who played Laura, and Phoebe Augustine, who played Ronette, reading the script, I agree with them that the original ending doesn't really work. As the show suggests, Laura demands that Leland Bob kill her, and he does. So the idea is explicit that she has to die to defeat him and avoid being possessed, which is pretty grim. And most people still seem to interpret this as being what happens in the movie. But in fact, she never says the line that was scripted, and Bob Leland kills her after she sees the angel for Ronette and takes the ring, an action that was also not in the script. It's a positive rather than a negative action, as well as a more visual and ambiguous direction to go in. Both qualifies Lynch-like in his storytelling. In the script, there is no angel in the red room with Cooper and Laura, so that scene does not read as joyous as it does in the finished film. Oddly enough, the scene description reads Black Lodge, the only time that phrase appears in the whole screenplay. But in the final cut, we can actually be pretty sure it isn't the Black Lodge because of the addition of the angel, Joel.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Joel that we're in the mid-season stretch of just emptiness. It's kind of like when you're driving between two big cities and you get past the suburbs and you get past the little rural towns, and then there's just nothing for miles and miles and miles. But we're trying to find the silver lining, and actually I think Joel and Daniel seem to be on the same page a lot of time, but I think Joel is a little bit less harsh on this episode overall. I think he kind of saw the looked at the lighthearted comedy part of it, and the sheer ridiculousness of the Nadine and Hank Jennings fight. It's at the same time it made me laugh out loud because it's hilarious, but it's also such a low point for you have two characters that the writers don't know what to do with, and they're just throwing them into this scene, and then what happens after that? I don't know, but anyway, thanks for writing, and this was. We're doing the best we can with what we've got.
I mean, both Daniel and Joel have talked about the throne that Briggs is sitting in and how it has the foliage around it, whether it's like a rainforest or jungle or something like that.
I was
Do you,
unclear about that,
well,
like what.
the only thing I could think of is that at the time when I was watching it, maybe it's supposed to be like a White Lodge thing and they're trying to invoke Eden or something like that. I don't know.
I mean, it's just as interesting as anything else because I felt like it was pretty ambiguous because it's not even in complete focus when it comes into the scene. And Briggs is sitting on it, on this throne with, like you said, the foliage around it and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden he's in the sheriff's office or the sheriff's station. So that's in his mind, and he's talking about the total recall he has of it, and then he comes back to it. But none of this goes any length to explain why he showed back up in a World War I aviator costume. So this, I don't recall if this comes later or if this is a thread that's not picked up and ran with or what. Do you remember off the top of your head why he shows up like that? What that has to do with
A jungle?
him sitting on the throne?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
it's just that. I feel like I said earlier, I feel like a lot of different elements are being thrown at the wall, and we're just kind of seeing what sticks. And this is one of those things.
So, Joel is talking about how it's the show decided that Laura had decided to die instead of being possessed. And that she ever But a lot of people still interpret the end of the movie as that this is what's happening, even though there's a line where she's supposed to say something along those lines, but she doesn't say it. And instead, Bob kills her after she sees the angel and then she takes the ring. And so it ends up being more a visual thing that is really left up to interpretation of that, which he also says that this is stuff that Lynch prefers doing. But as far,
So does Laura succumb to the evil, or does she conquer the evil by dying? Well, what's your take? You know, then not, I'm not asking you specifically, but I'm just saying it seems like that's left up to the viewer.
Well, I definitely think she conquers it. And I think this is just Lynch's preferred way of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Instead of being,
Explicit.
explicit, let's just tell it in a more artful way. And I think that's what he did. And that's what Joel's pointing out.
I still think it's crazy that Fire Walk With Me is the first thing of Twin Peaks that I ever saw. It's just like, wait a minute. What's going on here? Hold on a second.
I like the fact that Cheryl Lee and Phoebe Augustine were the ones who contributed to to change at the ending to make it more positive and not so grim. We wrongly assumed that it was studios. But we're just, I guess always thinking it would be because most of the time it is.
Yeah, usually it's the studios that go, okay, now can we interject some sort of sunlight into this so these people don't leave the theater going, oh my God, this was the biggest downer ever. And I think a lot of studios and a lot of filmmakers, screenwriters, whatever have you, have kind of taken this lesson, not necessarily from Twin Peaks per se, but just taken this lesson to heart and done it. I mean, even if you watch True Detective, this show is a downer pretty much from the first note. And it doesn't get very high after that. It just kind of keeps going down and down and down. And but at the end of it, even they interjected a little bit of hopefulness and sunlight and had that at the very end, when the two guys are walking off the screen.
Hopefully we get some more feedback. So, hey Tyler.
If you're still listening, what's up? And thank you to Daniel and Joel once again. Thank you very, very much.
Yes, thank you guys. It was very much appreciated. That's it for now. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.